say what? Oh, this is Brian. Call me the one who found himself no wiser than before, Gardner. Coming to you from the Devil's Hole, a.k.a. Ramble Towers. The Tower Studio. I haven't got a name for this one yet. I'm in the tower. Looking out over scenic Hespeler, Ontario. And you are listening to Ramble on Radio, episode 108. Ramble on Radio is the only Led Zeppelin podcast on this or any other known internets. Be sure to go to rambleonradio.com for all your Led Zeppelin news, reviews, and any links I might happen to mention during the show. You can subscribe to Ramble on Radio through iTunes. And if you're in iTunes, leave a review. Pop over, leave a review. You put a star, 2, 3, 5, whatever. And then a quick review. And it helps helps their computers see what we're doing, see what I'm doing here, and puts you better up in the placements on the if you search for Led Zeppelin, for instance, it'll come up higher on the list if there's more reviews. You can go to Podbean at I Am Brian Dammit and listen. You can listen on Spreaker. Spreaker. Podbean, by the way, has an app, so you can download the Podbean app. I believe Spreaker does too. If you go to Spreaker, be sure to follow Ramble On Radio. You can also check out Ramble On Radio on YouTube. And I have some, if you're curious what I'm looking at, I've been told before a few people, I just check out the YouTube to see what you look like. I have a few, swarms of ladybugs outside the window. There's like 5 of them on my screen. That's called an aside, folks. Yes, some people said they, you know, they go to the YouTube, but I have some old episodes that I've videoed, and so you can go see what I look like. Also on social media, follow Ramble On Radio on Facebook, Google+, and at Ramble On Blog on Twitter. And I meant to mention this last week, but Robert Plant had finished his tour. And we're probably going back a month now. And Wyatt Brake posted a few pictures of us from a show he went to. So thanks to Wyatt, and that's on the Facebook page. So if you go to Facebook and go down, you can see that. Wyatt and a few others kind of regularly post some videos that pop up and that sort of thing on the Facebook page. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, the Facebook page is the place. I try to kind of keep people updated on what I'm doing here via Twitter. And so that's the social media outlets where you can go. So, all right. So we heard, I'm so excited about this show. This is one or two on the list of shows I've done. I promise this is going to be, even though I've not done it yet, it's going to be a great one. That was Heartbreaker, you heard in the intro, Heartbreaker from the O'Keefe Center in Toronto on November 2nd, 1969. I played that because in the interview I have today, the O'Keefe Toronto shows, we talked a little bit about the Toronto shows, and my interview was with Richard Cole, the road manager for Led Zeppelin from December 1968 right through to 1980, and his story is long. He has a book. I mentioned it in the podcast. He in 92 or so, I think he said it was 92. It was released. He released a book called "Stairway to Heaven: Led Zeppelin Uncensored." Richard Cole is the author, and if you're looking for a Led Zeppelin biography, it is probably the one you want. It has all. It tells the whole story. Salacious details, and not, you know, the drug issues. It really focuses that he had a drug problem himself. He's very upfront about that very early in the interview. And, he's very clear in documenting, particularly Page and, Bonham's drug issues as well. And, so it was great to interview him. I was scared crapless because, I mean, these guys had a reputation for tough, you know, and I, one thing I know about people who, you know, run an international tour, who take bands city to city, who take bands through the myriad dishonesty that is the music business, is they don't take a lot of crap. They don't suffer fools. So I was fully expecting a kind of a, oh, get your act together. Which didn't happen. He was very nice. He was very nice. And I'll tell you the story of how I got him, because there is a bit of a story in my organizing it that goes along the lines of what I just said. We'll get there. Let me get to the interview. Let me get through this first. Days in history. In history. This kind of week in Led Zeppelin history. On November 2nd, 2007, I had the worst fight with my wife we have had in 25 years of marriage. And it was because they announced that the O2 shows scheduled for late November had been postponed. And we had to reorganize flights, and it was going to cost $1,800. That's on top of everything we'd already spent. And because there's like a 30-day limit on the flights cancellation, so we could cancel. We couldn't cancel our flight out, but we could cancel our flight back. This was the deal. It was myself and my brother going. And there was a 30-day or 21-day period or something where you could outside, but inside of that period you couldn't cancel. So our outbound flight we could not change, cancel. Our inbound flight back to Canada we could, but it was the last day of the period. Which is to say, the $1,800 extra it cost us would it be $3,600 the next day. We spent an hour and a half or so arguing on the phone, and then finally I said, "Got to do it. I got to do it. Go, do it." And the wife kind of said, "You got to sleep on this. It's $1,800." And she was kind of a little furious. And you know, when people get a little angry and they see this sort of thing, you can't rationalize with them that, look, it's just going to be more expensive tomorrow. It's not that I wanted to do this, it's that this is where it was going to be. And I understood her position. And the next day, two days later, she kind of came around and said, no, you did the right, you had to do what you did. So it's, you know, but it was probably the worst for her marriage. Yeah, it was not fun. So thanks, Jimmy Page. Thanks for that gardening 3 weeks before the show and putting me in that position and costing me all that money. October 31st, 1970, Led Zeppelin 3 hit number one on Billboard, stayed there for 4 weeks. October 31st, 1974, the UK launch of Swan Song was held at, it was a big party at Chislehurst Caves in the UK. And they're kind of a big, they're a tourist attraction now. Then they were a little more off the beaten path, I gather. But they threw a big party at these caves, these big caves, and they're just a bunch of big rooms that are actual caves in the wall. On November 4, 1969, Led Zeppelin played My Town, and this is mentioned again in my interview with Richard Cole. They played Kitchener Auditorium here in 1969, this week. November 7, 1970, Led Zeppelin 3 was released in the UK. It was released about a month earlier in this. I didn't realize this until I was going through some stuff. It was released about a month earlier in the States than the UK. And November 8th, 1971, Led Zeppelin 4 was released. That's coming up. That's 1971. And of course, that's a big deal. And you'll notice those are Christmas releases. So we're getting close to Christmas when you're getting into those albums that would have been Christmas releases. Jimmy Page is being honored with the EMP Founders Award in Seattle. EMP Founders Award features legendary performers who have made substantial contributions to the field of music. This is from their website. Quote, since its inception in 2007, the Founders Award has raised more than $2,625,000 in support of vital youth development programs. The annual Founders Award celebration is EMP Museum's signature fundraiser celebrating the life's work of living legends while meaningfully contributing to the institution's extensive education programs. This year, EMP will honor iconic musician Jimmy Page. Together with honorary chairs Paul G. Allen and Jody Allen, we are thrilled to honor Mr. Page's exceptional influence of music history as a groundbreaking guitarist, legendary songwriter, and visionary producer. This unique and unforgettable evening in honor of Mr. Page's EMP's premier benefit event to support museum's youth artistic development programs. The evening will open with an elegant dinner and a thrilling live auction and culminate in an unforgettable concert as star musicians take the stage to pay tribute to Jimmy Page's musical career. EMP honors artists whose contribution to music has touched the lives of many in the world over. Founders Awards have played the host remarkable group of musical superstars, including Jackson Browne, Billy Cox, Steve Cropper, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Buddy Guy, Robbie Robertson, Carlos Santana, and Nancy Wilson. So, bottom line, he's being honored with this this award in Seattle. Paul Allen is one of the founders of Microsoft, in case you're not familiar with that name. That's he's the honorary chair. It's his charity, I believe. And to be, this seems to be fairly clear, there will be a concert. It will not feature Jimmy Page. It will feature the music of Jimmy Page. So it'll be one of those Jimmy sits and looks while other people play. Presumably. Will he get up and jam? That's, I suppose, possible. I would not expect it. It is, apparently the event's sold out. If you're in the Seattle area looking for tickets, apparently it's sold out. And I don't know if you can get tickets now from secondary sources if you want to take the chance that Jimmy might actually be seen to be playing that guitar. But I wouldn't, I wouldn't anticipate for a second that he'll play. So it's just not the kind of venue where, you know, it seems logical that he'd get back to it. All right, our pal Dave Lewis has digitized Tight But Loose. It's now available through, and I yesterday downloaded this app, and it's not available yet. Dave Lewis is saying it's now available through Magster. It was not as of yesterday, but presumably it will be in the next few days, weeks. Magster, M-A-G-Z-T-E-R. They have all sorts of magazines available. It's one of those apps that, you know, I'll tell you, I'm not shocked by this, because probably about 2 years ago, I got an email from Dave. He was looking at digitizing, going for the digital Tight But Loose, and he wasn't sure, and he sent a very lengthy email walking me through his business model, really, his subscriber base, what he makes per magazine, what he would make per magazine digital, which is less, and that sort of thing, and what he was trying to figure out was would this be worth doing? Would it cost him sales on the magazine side, on the physical copy side? Would it cost him sales on the physical copy side? And how much more would he pick up through the Magster? And that's the question that he had to try and answer. Would he, at the end of the day, be better off going Magster, taking a little less per issue, but having the ability to get more sold? Or was he just cutting his throat, basically, making it available cheaper somewhere else? And so I answered a lot of questions for him. I think the primary one he was looking at was, would you still buy the, you know, what do you think? Would you still buy a physical copy? I suggested I probably would. He also asked, would you buy both? Because I guess some people do. I kind of said probably, but only because I'm doing this and I want to get it as quick as possible and review it. But it does have a collectability about the physical ones. I like getting them. But on the other hand, with what the pound is doing right now, or what the Canadian dollar is doing right now, it's infinitely more expensive this year than it was this time last year, and not looking like it's going to get cheaper. So it may become that a digital may be a solution for me, and it may be something I was wondering whether I'm going to renew. I would probably now get the magazine for sure through the Magster. Whether I renew my physical copy is not going to be affected by that, though. So I think it probably helps him in the long haul. But anyway, I there was an edition a year or so ago that was huge, and somebody commented, I can't buy this magazine anymore because I can't read it anymore. The print is too small. And the problem was, I mean, he runs it at about 16 or 18 pages, and if you're going to go a 40,000 word copy, you either got to add pages. But he doesn't add money when he adds pages. It doesn't cost, you know what I mean? So it's cost some money to add pages. It's easier to shrink the type. And in the digital stuff, you can go back to, you can set the type to however you want. So it would be more readable, I think, for people, us older people. Advantages and disadvantages. But check it out. Check Magster. I have no idea what he's charging per issue. But check Magster. Tight but Loose. TBL is the magazine on Magster. And I'll kind of keep you up to date as it comes available and what I see. All right, so Richard Cole, here's how this happened. Here's how this went down. This is, by the way, about a 35-minute interview. So I contacted Richard middle of last week, and I've commented before, it's tough to schedule things. So I was thinking Peter Grant is 20 years gone at the end of this month. I was thinking maybe something that week, and we could talk Peter Grant, reminisce a little about Peter Grant. So I wanted to give myself a couple of weeks' time to set it up, and because that's the way it always works. So I contacted Richard like Wednesday, and I mentioned that we both knew Dave Lewis, so perhaps he would want to check my bona fides with Dave. That I had interviewed Scarlett Page, and you include that, so he knows I'm not some. It gives me some credibility that I probably wouldn't otherwise have, right? It helps, and I pointed him to the episode with Scarlett Page, so that he could listen to the podcast if he wanted to listen to the interview and see that I'm not some groveling fanboy who a level of professionalism is provided. And then I sat back and went, and I figured this would all take, maybe a couple of days, maybe a week. Maybe he doesn't ever get back to me. If he does get back to me, he's going to go through this stuff. Saturday morning, I woke up to a message from him. How do you want to do it and when? So I kind of, I haven't even coffee yet. I sit down and I was, anytime in the next little while. My situation is I work shifts, so this is when I'm available. This is when I'm not kind of available. And, I use Skype or I can phone you on your phone, through Skype if you don't have Skype. So he sent me back almost immediately a message. Here's my Skype address. Here's my phone number. When? So I said, I'm on shifts this week. I can do, blah, 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 blah. And he sends back a message. How about today? 3:00. And no, I'm actually working today, and I'm out that time of day. But now I'm realizing, like I said, he's a take no crap personality. It's why he was successful in doing what he was doing. He's a schedule to sort out. Then the schedule needs to be sorted out. He wants answers. He wants answers to his questions now. So I'm kind of, as I'm going through this, this is all within maybe 5 minutes. Most people, you send a message, it takes a day to come back. So the next message was simply put, when then? So what I'm realizing now is pick a time, make it soon, get it done, or lose this interview. So how about tomorrow at 2:00, your time? And he called, but he kind of emailed back, I have lunch. I have a lunch date or something. I have a luncheon, I think it was. How about 3? Done. But now, I'm not prepared for this interview. I have nothing. I have to go to work in an hour. And I'm figuring, I'm not going to sit and start making all sorts of notes for my Richard Cole interview. So I scramble to grab a couple of books and take them to work with me. And I take a notepad to work with me and a highlighter. And we got home from work early, so it was a night in with the wife. Fortunately, we didn't have dancing or something to do. So we curled up in front of a movie, and I sat with the books, and I just crammed out about 12 questions. And then I kind of thought, I have enough information, conversationally, I have enough information in my knowledge base that I should be able to handle conversation with him fairly well on these topics. So anyway, that's where it comes down to. It all happened very fast. And this is it. This is Richard Cole. The guy traveled with Led Zeppelin. He was in their... he was in the plane with them. He was in the limos going to the show with them. He was side stage, backstage, front stage with them. He, you know, he was at every show between their first American show and Nebworth. He was not on, by the way, he did not go on their 1980 tour. And we get into that a little bit. But he was, other than that, up until that 1980 European tour, he was the guy. He was at every single show. He arranged everything. He arranged the drinks, and he arranged the drugs, and he arranged the girls. And he did it all. quite the life lived. You know, it's as close as I'm ever going to get to. Peter Grant's gone now. So, literally, other than guys who are on stage playing the instruments, this is as close as I'm ever going to get. Until John Paul Jones, Jimmy Page, Robert Plant comes on this show, this is it. This guy was the sixth Zeppelin member, really. And such a big deal to me. And I hope I did the interview justice. I hope you enjoy this interview. And here is Richard Cole on Ramble On Radio. Hello, Richard.
How are you?
Good, yourself?
Good, let me turn this down.
Okay. Start with, thank you for doing this.
That's cool, you're quite welcome. When did you last speak to Dave Lewis?
July.
Oh. He's a nice fella.
Yeah, I like Dave.
God, he's got some information. I don't know where he gets it.
I know, he probably knows more than you knew about the band.
He knows a lot more than I do.
You were there.
Yeah, right. That's what I mean.
I like Dave, though. He's good. We had a few too many beers one day in London last time I was there. So.
Ah, where are you based then?
I'm in Toronto area, Canada.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which, actually...
Ryerson University.
What's that?
Ryerson University.
Yeah, I have, my son's actually looking to go in there next year.
Oh, it's very good.
No.
It's a good university, isn't it?
It's a decent university, yeah. I think Toronto's better, but...
The only other one I know, it's funny you're talking about universities, because I lived in Montreal for about 3 months, was the McGill, I think, is it McGill University?
McGill University, yeah.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, that's a nice, really nice campus there. Well, since we're talking about Toronto, one of my questions is, and this is a bit off the, you guys never came back to Toronto after 1971. Any reason for that? Sure.
I mean, you, as I say, you know more than, most people know more than I do, because, you know, it's very easy to get things muddled up. I mean, the last time, I remember playing the Rock Pile.
Yeah.
I remember playing, is it the O'Keefe Centre?
Yeah, that's right. And then Maple Leaf.
Then we did the Maple Leaf Gardens.
Right, that's right.
And that was why that all stuck in my mind, because I'm not going to swear to it, as I say, because I've done so many concerts. But I think why it stuck in my mind, it was the biggest venue or indoor venue we'd done up until that time, because it's 16,000 seaters. It was Donald K. Donald.
Right.
And you're saying we never went back there?
Never went back to Toronto, no.
Wow, I didn't even know that myself.
Yeah, and I mean, you guys were in Buffalo, and so you went to Montreal and Vancouver, so it wasn't the border, and you were in Buffalo, so it wasn't the distance, you know?
No, I have no idea. I know, and I can't remember the year we did, because I remember saying the Queen Elizabeth Hotel is in Montreal, isn't it? So is there a Montreal Forum?
Yeah.
We did that. Would that be for Donald K. Donald? I suppose it would be. Would it be?
Yeah, yeah. I think
so. Maybe it was, I don't know. I mean, the promoters are the ones who bring you in.
Right. Yeah, you're just the traveling along and city to city, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I just wondered, it's an oddity that you guys didn't come back, so I've always wondered. Okay, so let's go to, I do have one other you question before we even get going. Did you really design the shirts that John Lennon and Ringo Starr wore on Revolver?
Well, I basically, my friend done the main design, Johnny Pierce, who owned Granny Takes a Trip. I had access to the studio because I was friends with Mal Evans. And Mal, I told him I was designing shirts and stuff, and like they liked the one I was wearing. So I brought them samples of material and had them made up for them.
Nice. That's kind of a cool trivia.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember, I always remember, I remember that. It was the first time I'd actually met them sort of personally. But they were doing For No One, and I always remember the French horn they used on it, because John Entwistle used to play a French horn from The Who.
Right. So, if I have my history right, you started working with Peter Grant for the new Vaudeville band? Is that the first
one? Yes, 1967. I believe I got the job on my 21st birthday. And how I got it was, I knew a guy called Mick Wilshire, who's still my friend today. I still see him when he comes to London. He was a guitarist, and I bumped into him in a hangout. It's a pub called The Ship near the Marquee, which was very, where all the musicians used to hang out. And he asked, I'd played drums with him down in Spain in 1966, I was in, 1965, in Sitges. And he told me he was looking for a road manager, and I said, who are you with? And he said, the new Vaudeville band. And I, you know, thought, oh my God. You know, but then also, then he told me he just got back from America and they were going off again in February. And I thought, you know, like most English kids, and especially in the music business, we all wanted to go to America. Because I, when I was with Unit 4 Plus 2 in 1965, I'd gone to see Jerry and the Pacemakers, or the band, I went with some of the band. He was playing one of the piers in Blackpool, and we went in his dressing room, and he was telling us all about America and showing us the... I don't know if they were real guns, but, you know, the cowboy stuff and all that he bought and told us all stories about it. So it just sounded a wonderful place to go. So Mick Wilshire said, well, you know, here's the number of the manager. We're getting rid of our road manager. Give him a call. And I believe I called him on my birthday. Or I called him before, but he was in America or he was unavailable. And I think it was on my birthday, because I remember I got the job, and afterwards Keith Moon and John Entwistle came round to my mother's house to celebrate my birthday, and then we went round a run of the clubs. And I think John Wolfe, who used to, I don't know if he's still there driving and doing something, he asked me if I wanted my job back as the doing the equipment for The Who, and I said, no, I'm going with the Vaudeville back because I want to go to America. And then, of course, I went and I went up to see Peter Grant, and was, I suppose he's quite a frightening man, but, you know, I always remember he said to me, one thing he said to me was, if you hear anything in this office, I don't want you to repeat anything, I'll cut your ears off. And then the other thing that apparently impressed him was, I said to him, I want £30 a week, take it or leave it. So apparently he thought, well, if he's going to talk like that to me, he won't have any trouble getting money out of the promoters when I send him off on the road. So that was it. I spent many years after that doing things with working with Peter.
Yeah, you worked for him for 14 years after that?
January 67 to roughly June 80.
Yeah. And since we're at 1980, in your book you talk about being a little displeased with him, that you were being left off the European tour.
No, I wasn't. I'd be perfectly honest with you. A lot of these things only came, I kind of worked out already in the press years and years later. I had a bad heroin problem. So Peter said to me, you've got to clean yourself, act up before you go away, before you go on this tour. So I went off to Italy. He sent me off to Italy. And then I got arrested there and God knows what else and spent 6 months there. And later, I mean, then John Bonham died and, you know, and then the band disbanded. But years later, I read that I was fired. But at the time, I didn't actually know it.
Oh, okay, so...
So whether he just... I don't think he... I don't know. But I don't think he actually sent me there to, you know, sort myself out, not thinking I was going to come back and do the tour. But then I go, I don't know, because who knows?
Who knows, yeah. I mean, he was not necessarily in the best shape at that time either, was he?
Well, not as well as I had seen him.
Yes. But did you ever afterwards reconcile? Did you talk to him afterwards?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I ended up, I put a hole in my esophagus when I was in America in 91 and he called me in the hospital and that. Then when I came back to England in 1984, then I worked for, I was offered a job sort of running some company that wanted to, I knew the guy, Cesar DeMova, wanted to put on concerts in Japan, in the Hiroshima of all places. And I brought Peter in. So, you know, we so shared it. I lived in the house in Mayfair, and Peter used to stay over there. So, you know, the last time I spoke to him was 94. And I had a band on that I managed called Femme to Femme at the Astoria in London. And he was going to come up and see them. And something else happened. Then the next time I was more or less back in England was 96, but I believe he died sometime round about there, but I'm not 100% sure.
I think it was 95 he passed, actually.
Okay, 95, so it was, that's right. The musical was in 96.
Yeah, 95, because it was 20 years ago this month.
Okay,
That's kind of the reason I'm covering Peter Grantother for the podcast.
All right.
Yeah, I have it written down here, November 21st.
In London, and I wasn't drinking then, so meet up in London and go and have coffee and that. 87, I was down his house. I'd seen him in Los Angeles, would have been 89, I think, was maybe the last time I'd seen him in London. But I would always call him when I went. I'm pretty much sure I always called him when I went to England.
Right. Yeah, that's good that you guys kept the relationship going.
Well, we've been through so many things between us, you know. Got divorces for God knows what else, you know, and supported each other. So, you know, you have these small fallings out, but they don't really mean anything, you know.
Right, yeah, right. He turned down a slot at Woodstock for the band.
I presume so. I mean, when I say I presume so, we played up the road, in a place called Westbury, which was, there's a lot of them over America. I did them in later years with Three Dog Night. They have sort of musicals going on there, and I think they're only open in the summer. They got revolving stage and this sort of business. And we were in, we'd already were contracted to play that at the same time as Woodstock.
Okay. I was going to lead to the question, like, the band didn't do TV, no singles, or tried to keep the singles away. The story was that he turned down Woodstock because they wouldn't be the band at Woodstock. In retrospect...
That's quite possible as well.
Yeah. In retrospect, was he right with that attitude? And I think he was, but...
I think so, because... Well, I don't know. I mean... You know, it seems when MTV came along and you could see people, you could always almost make a decision if you wanted to go and see them, you know, if it was worth your while, perhaps by the performance on television. If you wanted to see Led Zeppelin, you'd have to go to a concert to see them. That was the only chance you were going to get. And, you know, I'm sure we've all got our imaginations, and, you know, the music was obviously great. And so that was in someone's mind, and I thought, well, I've got to see what this band can do live.
Yeah, I agree. I do that. I mean, it's hard to argue with the success they had, but I was wondering, it's so unconventional way, even nobody's done it since that way, really.
I think some things you can only do once.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah. What would he have done with MP3 downloads and bootlegs all over the internet nowadays? How would he have done that?
Well... I'm more surprised. I'm extremely surprised at how many bootlegs there are, because we did our best to curtail anyone from doing any bootlegs. You know, check the stage, we check the boards, we do everything we possibly could. And yet there's hundreds, I'd say hundreds, but you more than likely know how many there is, and Dave Lewis certainly does.
Yeah, well, almost every show, right?
That's what it starts to look like, yeah.
Yeah, and even now, ones are slipping out. You know, there's more and more come out.
Well, what would he do? I mean, I don't know what he would do. I mean, there's very little you can do, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's, but would have drove him nuts, I think.
That certainly.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna get into his. Did you ever talk about the animals? He discovered the animals too, right?
Mike Jeffries discovered the animals, and this is as far as I know. Mike Jeffries brought them to Mickey Most, the producer, who was Peter's partner. And so Peter traveled with the animals. He also traveled with Herman's Hermits, because Mickey Most produced Herman's Hermits. The new vaudeville band was not his first management. His first management actually was... when I was with them, it was the She Trinity, a girl band, and a comedian called Ray Cameron, whose son is an enormous comedian in England now, but I can't remember his name. I don't know, it's Mike something or other. I just can't remember his name, but he's a very big comedian. And as I say, the new vaudeville band, Jeff Stevens came to Peter, because he knew him, and asked him to put a... There was no new vaudeville band on record. It was session musicians. And the record took off beyond anyone's imagination, and people were ringing up for the new vaudeville band to book concerts for them. So he went to Peter, and Peter put the new vaudeville band that went on the road together. And that was his first real sort of management job on his own.
Okay, yeah. And then you were also out with the Yardbirds.
Yes, yeah. I don't know the whole story, but basically whoever Mickey Most produced, there more than likely was some sort of deal, because Peter ended up as manager of the Yardbirds.
Right.
Yeah. And then Jeff Beck after at the same time.
Right. Well, they had a big office together, right? So it was natural that...
Yes. It was a large, big, large room with two desks in it.
Yeah. And no seats, as I understand, except for the two of them.
No, there was a couch.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I wonder when I was talking to Peter, you know, he was, one minute he'd be sort of be very stern, and then all of a sudden he'd sort of crack a smile. And, of course, it wasn't until I went to work for him and sat on the couch. And what used to happen was, when Peter was talking to someone, Mickey Most would be making faces behind them, and vice versa.
Right. Okay. Must have been a very intimidating environment.
Yeah, until you got to know them. I mean, they were both great guys.
Right. Right. And John Paul Jones marked, he was a really smart guy.
Yes.
And he said, his quote was, he could out-talk anybody.
Who, Peter?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just quick-witted and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, he also was, you know, he spent quite a few years on the road working for Don Arden. Who was, God bless him, a very fast talker as well.
And Sharon Osbourne's father, isn't he?
Yes, of course.
As a side note. And I have all these notes here I'm kind of running through as I'm talking to you here. So, but he was also, like, everybody thinks about Peter Grant as a big guy, as in heavy, overweight. How tall was he? He was a big, tall guy too, wasn't he?
Oh, he's taller than me. I'm 6'1". He must have been 6'6" at least.
Right. So that, even without the bulk behind him, that's intimidating.
Yeah, he was a big man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know what I wanted to deal with. I ran across this last night. Keith Richards had a comment that just recently, Rolling Stone, that Led Zeppelin was manufactured by Peter Grant.
manufactured. I don't think manufactured in the sense of what people look at today. I mean, basically what happened was in 1968, the Yardbirds did their last concert in Montgomery, Alabama. I had to fly to... I flew to Canada to pick up the new vaudeville band, and Peter and Jimmy went to New York, and subsequently, Jimmy and Peter, you know, put the band together. Jimmy knew what, you know, what he wanted in the caliber of musicians. But I don't really think, I wouldn't really call it manufactured. I mean, that's how I would have thought most bands started. I'm sure that, you know, when Keith met Mick, then they said, oh, I know a drummer who plays with so-and-so and a bass player who does this, and there's a other guitarist who does this. And so, yeah. You know, unlike today where a lot of them even go to stage school and God knows what else, and they are, you know, I mean, I worked for a band, well, I managed a band called Femme to Femme. Yeah, they were manufactured. I mean, the girls never sung a note in their life except one of them.
Right.
But they look fantastic. So, you know, I think it's a sort of different... Manufacturing has a different sort of, in a different context. I wouldn't say that Led Zeppelin were manufactured. You could say that the other band I worked for, Rod Stewart and Jeff Beck. I mean, Jeff Beck was Jeff Beck. He needed a guitarist, a bass player, and he needed a singer, and he got Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
And so I don't really call it manufactured.
When you went out with that band too, right? You were on the road with them.
Yes, I did a few tours with Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart. Yeah.
So Rod Stewart in his autobiography talks about Jeff Beck living a completely different life from them.
Yeah. Well, I love the original band, which was Ronnie and Jeff and Mickey Waller on drums, just the four piece. I always thought they were really powerful, and then they got Nicky Hopkins, who's a brilliant musician. But the problem is, in those days, you know, you couldn't mic the piano to the same volume as the Stax and Marshall, so they lost a lot of power, if that makes sense, coming out of those amps. Right. It sort of, to me, it toned it down a bit. But I mean, I'd known Ronnie for years. It's quite ironic because the beginning of 1968, I was on tour with a band called The Creation, and Ronnie was the guitarist with them, and the lead singer was Kenny Pickett. The end of 1968, Kenny Pickett was the first road manager for Led Zeppelin.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, talk about swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, it seems like the music world of the late 1960s seems like a very small one sometimes.
It was small, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories is Rod Stewart talking about they stayed at a different hotel. Jeff Beck was at the Plaza, but they weren't. And were talking to Jeff Beck out front of the Plaza, and the limo pulled up to take him to the show. And
that's not true.
He jumped in and drove off without them.
No, it's not true.
No, that's from Rod Stewart's autobiography.
Yeah, but you know, listen, everyone puts bits in autobiographies. But no, I mean, no, because first of all, there was not much money around.
Right.
And so, no, we stayed at the Gorham Hotel in New York.
Okay. Yeah, that's where he says that he and Wood, and they shared a room,
he said. Yeah, no, that's true. I was trying to work it out. They shared a room, so that left Jeff, I think Mickey Waller and Peter Sanders, who was the road manager, or equipment manager, must have shared a room, and then Jeff and I had our own room.
Okay. So, yeah, he wasn't doing the suite at the
club. Unless I shared with Jeff, but I can't, I mean, I know I'd shared with Jimmy, but I can't honestly remember with Jeff, to be perfectly honest.
A couple more Peter Grant questions. I have a favorite Peter Grant story, and it's his daughter tells it. Him showing up in that 1920s car he had, with his scarf and the goggles and the hat to pick her up from school, and she would come out and say, "Oh, can't you be like the other dads?" He had a flamboyant side, didn't he?
Well, he liked his cars. Yeah, there was, of course, a flamboyant. There was a showmanship side to him. You know, I mean, he was in theatres and he was also an actor, a wrestler, so, you know, I suppose he did have that side to him.
Yeah, and the other one was, there's the rumors that there were crocodiles in the moat at his house.
No, they like salt water, the crocodiles.
That's not probably true. But yeah,
it was a big pike in there. I know that because okay. We used to try and fish for it. Yeah.
That was, apparently the taxi drivers wouldn't come out there because there was rumored to be crocodiles. Okay, let's move past Peter and talk a little bit about your own. I have your book in front of me, by the way. We should tell everybody it's called Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin Uncensored. And how long ago was it? What was that, 20 years ago that came out?
1992, yeah.
Yeah, 23. Wow, long time. Time flies. I haven't read it in a long time, so I don't have the details all, but my impression, thinking back on it, was you felt very close to John Bonham.
When we started off, Jimmy and I always shared rooms and suites. Because I knew Jimmy, I knew John Paul Jones, but I knew Jimmy best. But then as the years went on, I became, closer to John Bonham.
Yeah.
Not shared suites or anything, but, you know, he sometimes needed a little bit more looking after, should we say.
Right. So, there's always stories about him having... I mean, he had a wild side, but everybody kind of finishes their stories with, oh, but he was such a lovable guy.
Well, he didn't. He got a point where he really didn't like going on tour. I mean, he missed his family, and I mean, you know, and he used to get quite morose about it.
Right.
You know, on the other hand, when you're in a band like that, you can't... People have done it, but you can't just walk away.
No, there's a lot of money on the table, and... contracts
and everything else that goes with it, so, and the lifestyles and everything else, so, you know, that's what you that used to, you know, upset him. Then he had a period where he didn't like flying, so he went through, you know, quite a few little struggles in a sense.
We talked a little earlier about some shows, and you kind of indicated you don't always remember these so well, but in 1968 they played the Boston Tea Party, kind of a legendary show.
Oh yes.
You remember that one?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't forget it. I mean, I was familiar with it. I'd done it first. I did it first with the Yardbirds. In 1968. Then I also did it with Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart in the summer of 68-ish. And then Led Zeppelin, I believe it was the beginning of 1969. But they couldn't get off the stage. God knows how long they played for. I mean, they ran out of things that they all knew to play even in the end. And that's saying something.
Yeah. Yeah, they were doing Chuck Berry numbers and whatnot.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier about it, but it's the one show, or the one part of that show, I guess, isn't bootlegged, so it's lost in time.
Yeah, that was, and then on top of that, there was a DJ there called J.J. Jackson.
Right.
And he played, you know, he played the first album, and I think that's, could be pretty much what broke them.
Right, okay. And and before that was the West Coast shows, right?
I get confused because obviously I look at different things. I mean, I can remember the five dates with the Vanilla Fudge, and then we left them and we played the Whiskey, we played San Francisco. I don't know what we played in New York.
I think you played Fillmore East.
Fillmore, so yes, that's right. It was the Fillmore East. But there's someone said that we played somewhere in Iowa, but I cannot remember it. It would have been too off the beaten track because, to be perfectly honest with you, in 1968, that period, and early '69, There was only about 5 or 6 venues across America that would take these bands. When I say these bands, I'm talking about a Led Zeppelin type of band. The Yardbirds played different places because they also had the pop group sort of, you know, they've had a lot of hit records.
Right.
So people knew who they were in sort of remote places. But people like Beck and Stewart and Led Zeppelin, they used to have to keep to the more progressive promoters like Don Law at the Boston Tea Party and Bill Graham and also the Whiskey. And then there was another place called the Shrine. So I don't know. I'm still confused about this gig they're supposed to have done in Iowa because it was... I don't remember it. I mean, I remember more or less, and I can't remember where, because Detroit and Chicago are also in there somewhere.
Right.
And I know, I'm pretty, more or less 100% sure that we finished off at the Image Club in Florida, and then I thought we flew home. Then other times I read stuff and says that we played Boston, so I'm confused about it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm pretty sure we flew home after the Miami thing because I flew back with them. Because right. By then, Peter and I had worked out an agreement that I would stay with Led Zeppelin and not go from one band to another.
Right. And, well, pretty much by then, that was Peter Grant's only band, wasn't it?
Yes, Jeff Beck, Rod Stewart thing right. Sort of fell apart. Yeah. There was still Terry Reid.
Okay. What was he like? Because he was offered the slot as singer. What was he like? I really don't know him. As a singer, I mean.
What was Terry like as a singer?
Yeah.
Oh, he was fantastic.
Was he?
Yeah, he was. They had. It was only a trio. Peter Sully and Keith Webb on drums. No, he was a great singer.
Yeah. Could would he fit in well with Zeppelin or?
Oh, that's very difficult. I mean, Robert's got, well, I suppose Terry's got a distinctive voice, but Robert is a voice you don't forget, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And of course, if it's Terry Reid singing, then John Bonham doesn't make it on the drums either, does he?
No, because Robert brought him in.
Yeah. Were you around when they were, well, I mean, you were working for Peter at the time, but... But when they were putting the band together, when they went to see Robert, when they went to see...
I'll tell you a couple of funny stories. I worked with the Searchers. And the last concert I did with the Searchers was the 31st of December 1966. And we played at Birmingham Town Hall. And as it was only me who used to have to set all the equipment up and do everything... You know, sometimes the drummers of the support band, because they'd never seen a kit as good as, you know, the ones that the headliners play, used to like to have a play on them if you could. So I used to let them set the drums up, and I'd tune them afterwards. But one day, the drummer who happened to set the kit up for me was John Bonham. But of course, I didn't know that until maybe a year later, oh, 2 years later, when we were flying somewhere. But the first time I met them was in the office when I'd come back in 1968, maybe in September, I think it was, to do something for Beck and Stewart in, where was it? Somewhere up in the Scandinavia, Stockholm or Copenhagen, one of those places. And the two of them were sitting there in the office. And then the next time, the next time I met them was, I think it was the day before Christmas Eve, 23rd of December 1968.
So you didn't go on the Scandinavian tour?
No. I was working for Terry Reid then in America.
Okay. Yeah, that was one of my questions, was whether you were on that. So the first time you heard them play would have been opening for Vanilla Fudge in Denver, I think it was.
It was in Denver.
Yeah.
In Denver, Colorado, 26th of December, 1968.
Wow. So what was your first impression?
That they were great, but it wasn't until a couple of days later I realised, I think I was in Portland, and I was watching the Bonham doing the drum solo, you realised, you know, just what they were all like.
Right.
And put together, they were just incredible. I mean, it was very exciting because, I mean, they basically just wiped the floor with everyone everywhere they went.
I was 14 when they played. The day of their last show in the States was my 14th birthday. So I don't remember.
1977.
Now, yeah, July 24, 77.
Right. I'm not arguing with you. I don't know why I thought it was August, but there you are. You're more likely to remember it better than I do.
Yeah. Yeah, it sticks in my mind. Obviously, because of my birthday, it sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But I've met people through the years who saw them in those early years, and the one thing they all say is, boy, they were loud.
I suppose they were. when they're the only band you're working for, you can't really gauge it.
Right.
But I'm sure they were loud. I mean, you know, they had a very good PA system, which increased in size every fucking tour we did.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, was it 69 you played I want to say Radio City Music Hall, no, Carnegie Hall. And Chris Dreja went to the show. And he says it sounded like a war. He couldn't believe it.
Well, yeah, by the middle, that would have been the middle of the year, it was the summer. I mean, they worked a lot, so, you know, by the time they got to the middle of the year, I mean, you're talking about something that was real. They all almost, you know, they get the musicians, they can read each other's thoughts.
Right.
And that really, you know, that's what really tightens the band up.
Right. Right. When they shot off to the cottage in Wales,
mm-hmm.
And they took a couple of roadies with them, is what they've always said. Were you one of those?
No, they took Clive Coulson and Henry Smith.
Okay. I just thought I wondered that. And I'm kind of out of questions here. anything you want to talk about? Any?
Not really. No.
No.
I'm terrible at it. You have to drag it out of me.
that's all right. Yeah. So I sat last night and made all sorts of notes, but I'm out of notes. Okay. So why don't we leave it at that? That's been half an hour anyway.
Oh, okay.
It goes fast, doesn't it?
It does go fast. Yeah. It's just time for my afternoon tea and a nap.
Oh, nice. I'm on my way to a hockey game, actually.
Oh, what more can I expect from a Canadian?
That's right. Interestingly,
the afternoon.
Yeah, in 1969, you guys played at the arena where I'm going, so.
Which one?
Kitchener Auditorium.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember that one?
No. I mean, I remember the Kitchener. I think I also did it with, I could have done it with Three Dog Night, but I don't.
It's possible.
You know, to remember all those ones, I mean, we worked a lot. I mean, in 1969, we spent so much time on the road in America. At one point, we had to leave the country.
Right. Otherwise, you'd be eligible for the draft.
For tax reasons.
Yeah.
I think we flew back. I think we played Boston, and then Jimmy and Robert and I flew to Puerto Rico. The others went home. And then I think we rejoined up to play Buffalo.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, well, the Kitchener show is actually remarked because Robert Plant wore furry boots that night.
Furry boots?
Yeah, like mucklucks, I guess you would call them.
God.
And, you'll see pictures of him once in a while, and it's the only show I think he ever wore them.
He used to. I'm pretty sure some of the first gigs we did, he used to be barefooted.
Oh, is that right?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Wow. I've never heard that.
Is it with that or he wore flip-flops? But I'm pretty sure he used to... I've seen him singing with his bare feet.
Wow.
On stage.
Oh, that's neat. Okay, let's leave her there, and you get on with your tea.
All right. Well, it's nice talking to you, Brian.
It was very nice talking to you. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're more than welcome. And enjoy the hockey game.
I will.
All right. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye. And there you have it. I have been blessed by
by Richard Cole. Who would have thought that would ever happen? Hope you enjoyed that interview. He says at one point that you kind of have to pull stuff out of him. And I find Skype very awkward to work with. And I guess phones too. When it comes to being conversational, it's hard to know the difference between letting him finish a line and tripping over somebody. And so there's some very awkward pauses that are my fault. That amount to just not sure where that the conversation's done, I think if two guys sitting together, you get a better groove of the interview, and this is a very awkward way to do it sometimes, and I think there are times when that pops up, but I think there was some interesting information there. Us real Led Zeppelin geeks, there's not a whole lot new. Because there's not a whole lot new to learn for it in a lot of cases. However, the bit at the end about Robert Plant singing with bare feet, I've never seen a picture of that. Whether he did or not, I don't want to doubt Richard, but he seemed to be not 100% sure himself. I would love to see pictures of that from those early days. Love his comment about the bootlegs. I'm surprised how many there are, because we did our best to curtail anyone from doing bootlegs, and yet there's hundreds. There's like I said, almost every show I have a pack of MP3, a 32 gigabytes drive with MP3s, full of MP3s, just about every show that is known to be bootlegged by Led, and it's certainly everything after 75, possibly everything after 72 or 73 seems to be bootlegged. I mean, there's any holes in the bootleg record, it's really 69 and maybe 70. Some of those ones they did a small tour at the end of 1970. I think it was. It might have been 71, but they did small hauls and whatnot. And some of those aren't that well documented on bootleg. But after that, pretty much everything is. It's astounding. I enjoyed talking to him. But you do get the sense. And there's a bit of an odd clip cutting at the beginning. And that's because there was kind of a conversation with, what do you want to talk about and stuff. It started off on the run, and then we moved into, it was no kind of start and end to the interview. So I'm trying to find the right spot to start it. There's a bit of cutting, and it's just that, about 3-5 seconds into the interview, there's a bit of a snip that probably seemed awkward to you. Other than that, it's the whole interview. I didn't want to be cutting and pasting stuff and just let the interview go. So that was it. That was one of the highlights of, the 5 years or whatever I've been doing this. That's an absolute highlight. Thank you so much to Richard Cole for coming on and doing that. It was an honor, and it was, I was quite nervous asking him. I figured for sure it would be a no, go away. So I was so surprised when he said yes, and I was so nervous because I was so really unprepared. That's the way it goes. Thanks, Richard Cole. He put up with my unpreparedness as much as you would expect, and got through it. We got through it and had a nice third. Well, it's 35 minutes at the end of the day, so that was. And this podcast is now. Longer than I like them to be, an hour, 6 minutes. So I'm going to sign off now and leave you alone. Next week we'll be, in a couple of weeks, we're going to actually talk Peter Grant on the anniversary of his death. I'm going to run through, I've got his biography, I'll review that, but I'll also run through the real key points of his life and have a long conversation about Peter Grant in about 2 weeks. But I'll be back next week. I got an idea for next week, and we'll see how it rolls out. But thanks for listening. That's it for Ramble on Radio, episode 108. Check rambleonradio.com for notes on this week's podcast, for Led Zeppelin news and reviews, and any links mentioned in today's podcast. Follow Ramble on Radio on Facebook, Google Plus, and at Ramble on Blog on Twitter. You can subscribe to Ramble on Radio through iTunes. Don't forget to leave a review if you're in iTunes. Listen on Spreaker. Be sure to follow Ramble on Radio on Spreaker and check it out at Ramble on Radio on YouTube. Thanks for listening to Ramble on Radio, episode 108. Keep it coolin', babies.
I'm sure there'll be internet forums telling me what I'm doing.
Switch off the internet.